Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast. Check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. While you're over there, make sure you check out all the other stuff that 1517 is doing. All the articles, all the videos, all the events, all the preaching helps, all the things that we're doing, all the other podcasts that we're doing. There's so much stuff. If you've never been over to the site, go over there and do that. Hey, if you've never rated 30 Minutes in the New Testament on iTunes, do that. If you've never gave it that great positive review, make sure you do that too. That's an easy way to help us, because the more that stuff that happens, the more you pop up in the searches, and that's great for us. So if you haven't done that and you like the podcast, please consider doing that. We'd really appreciate it. Eric, this is the week that we are going to be in Northwest Arkansas together. When this comes out, you'll be here by the time this comes out.
That is correct, and I'm excited about it. Our conference is sold out. I mean, packed to the gills with all sorts of people from all over the country, which is, that's fun. That'll be great. Looking forward to great talks, great music, great concert, great fellowship, and possibly even, based on your word, great pizza. We'll see.
That's right.
I know I can get great barbecue there, Dan. I've had it. Yeah. I approve. I mean, it's almost as good as the barbecue I had in Brooklyn. And maybe that will be the case with the pizza that I have, too. It will almost be as good as the pizza I used to eat on a daily basis in New York.
I'll accept that.
I'm just saying.
I'll accept that it's almost as good as the pizza in Brooklyn. I'll accept that review. I do not accept barbecue almost as good as Brooklyn. I don't receive that at all.
You just fundamentally reject it?
Yeah, I reject it out of hand. and I know that that's a lie from the devil. And I'm not going to hear that. But
okay, well, that was just temporary. I promise everything else that will come out of our mouths today is from the scriptures and therefore trustworthy.
Yeah. Well, last week we got to explore a well-known story, woman at the well, as it's commonly referred to.
Indeed. And,
Jesus has to go out of his way to go have a meeting with this woman of Samaria. And we broke down that story. We had to end sort of before the conclusion of the story. We kind of ended with her running off to the other people in the town saying, hey, there's this guy that knows everything about me. And could this be the Messiah? Also, the disciples show up and they don't have any idea what's going on because they were out trying to find lunch or something. And they come back and they're like, what is Jesus doing talking to this woman from Samaria? Two things that they don't understand with that. Why is he talking to a woman? Because that's not something that they did.
And why is he talking to a person from Samaria?
Period. Yes.
Yeah. We don't engage with them. As a matter of fact, we know that the disciples' attitude about Samaritans wasn't all that positive because of what's recorded about what James and John say as they're going through Samaria, and they're not getting the kind of reception that they expect, and they ask the Lord if he'll give them the power to call down fire on them.
Yeah, they want to nuke it from heaven, and Jesus says, yeah, you don't really get what I'm all about yet.
That's
and
right.
So, you know, we pick it up in verse 31 here, and the disciples are not going to ask Jesus about this whole Samaritan thing. Instead, they're going to say, all right, I don't know what's going on here, but who's hungry?
That's right. It says, verse 31, meanwhile, the disciples were urging him, saying, Rabbi, eat. But he said to them, I have food to eat that you do not know about. So the disciples said to one another, has anyone brought him something to eat?
This is hilarious.
If you just read it for what it is, face value, this is the disciples being like, wait, what's he talking about?
Secret food.
Did somebody give him a snack?
Yes.
That's literally what it is. They don't get the mystery. They don't get the cryptic way that Jesus is talking at all. Not surprising considering the track record of the disciples up to this point and really throughout Jesus's entire ministry. And so Jesus says to them, verse 34, my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. In other words, what Jesus is saying is the thing that ultimately sustains me is accomplishing the Father's will. And this is what Jesus is here to do. He is here to accomplish all that we have not been able to accomplish due to the fact that we are sinners. But so his whole life, again, we emphasize this all the time, his whole life, in a sense, is one in which he is living on our behalf as well.
Yeah. And here he's sort of answering the question that they don't ask, which is, what's he doing talking to that Samaritan woman? And then they say, hey, you want some food? And he says, look, I don't need food. I got food that you don't know about. In other words, I'm sustained by something you don't understand. And my food is to do the will of him who sent me and to accomplish his work. And guess what I was just doing? That thing that you didn't understand? That was me accomplishing his will. This is why I had to come here. This That's is right. the work that I was sent to do. The very thing that you can't wrap your mind around, the very thing that you had your jaw on the floor about when you walked up and saw me talking to that woman, actually, that was feeding me.
Yes.
Because that was the work I was sent to do.
Even though the disciples don't mouth their thoughts, of course, Jesus knows their thoughts, and so he answers their question for them without them having to say it. He says in verse 35, do you not say there are yet 4 months, then comes the harvest? Look, I tell you, lift up your eyes and see that the fields are white for harvest. Already the one who reaps is receiving wages and gathering fruit for eternal life, so that sower and reaper may rejoice together. For here the saying holds true, one sows and another reaps. I sent you to reap that for which you did not labor. And Dan, if there is any message that any preacher of the gospel, anyone who shares the gospel ever should remember, this is one of those messages. Jesus is the one who has done the sowing. He's done the labor, all the things necessary in order to save sinners. And our job as the church is simply to go out and reap that which he has sown.
Yeah, this is why he talks about it. Others have labored, being him, and you have
or the prophets before him or whatnot. Sure.
And you have entered into their labor. So you have That's been brought right. into their work.
That's right. That's the whole picture here. And so when he talks about the fields being white for harvest, this still applies today. The reality is we don't know who is ready. We don't know who is on the verge of conversion. There's a mystery there to us. The Spirit goes where he will, as John 3 says. And, you know, it's sort of like the wind. We're not exactly sure how to predict what that's all going to look like. But nevertheless, yes, even people like this Samaritan woman that would seem completely out of bounds for somebody as worthy as Jesus to the disciples is, in fact, ready to receive the word. And it's just a word of encouragement to know that that could be anyone around us at any given time. You just never know where a person is at and what they're ready to receive.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
So it says, verse 39, many Samaritans from that town believed in him because of the woman's testimony. He told me all that I ever did. That was her testimony. Now, I just, side note here, Dan, that we didn't emphasize as much last time. I love the fact that this woman's quote-unquote witness is, number one, so simple, and number two, used so powerfully by God to cause the gospel to spread.
Yeah.
She's doing missionary work, and she doesn't even know it. She doesn't recognize that she's witnessing. She didn't have to be given a pep talk from Jesus. Now, listen, you need to go and do this. It overflowed from within her. She met the Lord and then was like, other people need to know about this man. Other people need to know about this ministry. So I'm going to tell them so that they can see.
Yeah. And you're talking about her going around telling a community, this man told me everything I ever did. And this community also has to know what her life has been like. And we talked about that. We can't speculate too much, but we know that she's had a rough go of it in relationships for whatever reason. And we're not told the reason, but she's been married 5 times. She's currently with someone that she's not married to. And so she goes and said, this guy told me about all of that. And you have to believe that sort of combined with that message was, and he was patient and kind and loving to me and told me that the promises of God were for me and that the time is now at hand, that the separation between us and the Jewish people is going to come to an end. Like these are things he told me those things, and he verified that I could, the reason I can believe that those things are true, because he also told me things that he couldn't possibly know, which is everything I've ever done.
Yes, that's right. And so when the Samaritans came to him, verse 40, they asked him to stay with them, and he stayed there 2 days. And what happened? Many more believed because of his word. And never forget this, folks, as much as his miracles are impressive and do draw crowds throughout his ministry, as we will see, what transforms the heart is always the word.
That's right.
The word is the active means by which God is able to create faith in the sinner in Jesus Christ.
Faith is the only miracle that saves anyone. And don't be confused, it is a miracle that anyone believes.
That's right.
But all of the other miraculous things that we would think are of as more miraculous than faith, they don't save. Jesus making a blind man see doesn't save anyone. Doesn't even save the blind man. The thing that saves is faith. And so these things can make you interested. They can validate the words that are being spoken. But it is the words of salvation that create faith, and that faith is what saves you.
Absolutely. And if you didn't believe that, you just have to take one small look at the history of the nation of Israel, who have numerous miracles done right before their eyes. And yet that doesn't guarantee by any stretch of the imagination that that creates faith. As a matter of fact, it tends to not, depending on the person, I mean, it could create just as much unbelief or more unbelief.
Well, the reality is that's
the sinner.
Well,
look at
the response that they have. They don't talk about anything he does, period, here. They say, it is no longer because of what you said, that being the woman, that we believe, for we have heard for ourselves, this is heard right from the mouth of Jesus, and we know that this is indeed the Savior of the world.
Yes. So again, it's that faith coming by hearing. That's what you're seeing illustrated here with the Samaritan people. So verse 33 says, after the 2 days, he departed for Galilee, for Jesus himself had testified that a prophet has no honor in his own hometown. Now, John adds that note parenthetically in verse 44, which really kind of sums up what other gospels tell us happened, which is, in fact, Jesus went to the synagogue, went and spoke in the synagogue, declared himself, they certainly would have known it, that he was the Messiah, and they sought to throw him off a cliff. Now, of course, he escaped that execution attempt, but nevertheless, that is the reality of what happened when he went back home to Galilee. So when he came to Galilee, verse 45 says, the Galileans welcomed him, having seen all that he had done in Jerusalem at the feast, for they too had gone to the feast. So there is, of course, always, no matter where Jesus goes, there seems to be this mixed reception. On the one hand, you have those in authority that tend to be really threatened by him and want to get rid of him. On the other hand, you tend to have the poor and the outcast and the people that, you know, are seen as nobodies that are more than happy to have him in their midst, which seems to be the case here.
Right.
So now we move on. It says, so he came again to Cana in Galilee, where he had made the water wine. And at Capernaum, there was an official whose son was ill. When this man heard that Jesus had come from Judea to Galilee, he went to him and asked him to come down and heal his son, for he was at the point of death.
And now, there's something that's interesting here is that we talked about this when Jesus turned the water into wine. You know, there's only a select number of people that know anything about this. Those would be the servants.
That's
right. It would appear that these servants have not kept their mouths shut.
That tends to be the case, Dan.
It does tend to be the case. And so the word is now spreading that this is what happened at the feast. This is how this went down. So word is spreading. And so this guy, I love using this phrase because Luther likes to use this phrase. This man starts believing, or at least hoping, in Jesus based on a rumor.
That's right.
He's heard a little something, and his son is ill, and he thinks maybe, just maybe, if this man can change water into wine, if that's true, maybe he can do something for my son.
And what I find fascinating, again, this is, again, something that you don't expect. Just like the story of the water being turned into wine, where Mary asked him initially to help out, essentially, and he was like, woman, it's not my time, and it seems like that's not the kind of response you'd expect from Jesus. So too, verse 48, Jesus said to him, unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. It almost seems like a rebuke, Dan.
Yeah, so I don't think that this is a rebuke simply to him, but this is what is true of the people.
That is true of the people. And it could also be just a statement of fact about one of the reasons or explaining one of the reasons that he does these signs and wonders throughout his ministry, that there's a certain segment of people that need to have that done in order to validate that he's worth listening to. That's true. But I think that this in general, because of the context, has to do with the sort of hardened hearts of just the general population in that area.
Well,
at least if you look at the other gospel accounts, that's what we seem to get.
Yeah, and you know this partially too, because this "you" would be better translated "y'all," because this is a plural. So the unless you see signs and wonders, you will not believe. That "you" is plural.
That's right. That's right. So that lends itself to us thinking it's not just him being mean to the guy. But nevertheless, I love the official's response because, again, it is the response of faith. The official said to him, "Sir, come down before my child dies."
Dude, now, here's what's great about this. There's not a question mark at the end of this sentence.
No, there is not.
Jesus is like, "You just want these signs and wonders, and if you don't get them, you won't believe." And this dude goes, "Hey, man, my child's dying. Get down there." It's great.
I love it.
It's great because if you take the account of Jesus turning water into wine, we talked about how Jesus couldn't help himself as the servants were in this desperate situation. And Mary knew that this was going to be the case. That's why she just turned them over to him. And then Jesus was in a bind and he had to act because of who he is. This man is doing the same thing where Jesus is like, "Yeah, you just want signs and wonders. If you don't get them, you won't believe." And this man just turns him on his son and says, "My son is going to die. Come down before that happens."
Yes.
And Jesus, once again, he cannot help himself.
Can't help himself. Verse 50, Jesus said to him, "Go, your son will live."
That's
and
it.
That, it's that simple. It's that simple. At the word of Jesus, life is created.
Well, and you have this line, it's important. The man believed the word that Jesus spoke to him and went on his way. And as he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering.
Now, folks, there is an illustration for us as we walk through our lives as Christians, because frankly, it's going to feel the same way. We have already been declared righteous by faith in Jesus Christ. As a matter of fact, Ephesians goes so far as to say it's as if we are already risen and seated with Christ in the heavenly realms.
Mm-hmm.
Don't believe me? Look it up. Chapter 1 and chapter 2 are pretty clear about that, that we are positionally seen as if we are already seated next to Christ. And yet, how does it feel? Well, it feels like Jesus has declared that to be true, but we, believing in his word, go walking forward, trusting that it's true.
Right.
That's how this feels. He hasn't seen yet his son alive, but he trusts in the word of Jesus that he will be alive. And so it says, as he was going down, his servants met him and told him that his son was recovering. So he asked them the hour when he began to get better. And they said to him, "Yesterday at the seventh hour, the fever left him." The father knew that was the hour when Jesus had said to him, "Your son will live." And he himself believed, and all his household. This was now the second sign that Jesus did when he had come from Judea to Galilee.
Yeah, so he believed as he left. He heard the news, and he believed again. This is belief upon a belief. It's belief upon belief.
And that is the way it goes for us as well, folks. You know, I think sometimes, Dan, in American Christianity, depending on how much your background is connected to churches that have altar call type experiences, that sort of thing, we can almost think of faith as being this thing that started one time and now I've got it, and so like, or I had it, and so I'm good to go. But there's a living sort of active nature to this. Like, we don't just believe once, but we belief is this ongoing thing. And so it's totally understandable that it would say at the beginning of this, he believed his word. And then after this, I believe his word again.
Yeah, well, I don't know about you, Eric, but sometimes I got that mustard seed of faith, and sometimes I got that mustard tree of faith. And
that is correct. Or sometimes I'm not even sure I got that mustard seed of faith.
Yeah, dude. I mean, sometimes that faith is looking very, very small. And sometimes it's looking very big. And that does not mean that faith doesn't go and look small again. It certainly does. But that is the Christian life. It is. There are moments where I feel like I certainly believe. There are moments where I cry out, I believe, help my unbelief, where I have doubts and questions. And that is the way it goes.
That is correct. So now we enter into chapter 5. After Jesus has performed this second sign, it says, after this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the Sheep Gate a pool in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has 5 roofed colonnades. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be healed?"
That's an amazing question.
Just imagine, after 38 years, you have to sort of put yourself in the place of the blind, the lame, and the paralyzed.
Well, they're there These for a reason. People... They're there to try to be. This isn't just like coming across a guy and you're wondering, does this guy want to be healed, or is he making a pretty good living begging on the street or whatever? Maybe that's possible. These people are at this pool for the reason of trying to get healed, which is going to explain this in the next section here. But that's the whole purpose of them being around the pool.
That is correct. They have this idea that the pool may have some sort of healing potential. And so that's the place that you hang out. It's also probably a place that you can have access to people that would be willing to give alms. And so it functions in a couple of different ways for these people. So it seems like an obvious question. Do you want to be healed? Well, the sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me into the pool when the water is stirred up. And while I am going, another steps down before me."
Yeah, so the
so
idea
he doesn't get that Jesus is offering something different.
Right.
He just thinks, well, yeah, I want to get into the pool, but I can't get there.
Right.
Can you help me?
Yeah, the idea here is that the water gets stirred up and the first one down and it potentially gets healed. Does this happen? I don't know. But that's the idea. And so this man is lame and he can't get down there before other people beat him to it.
That's right. And so Jesus shocks the man and shocks the world.
Says, forget about that pool.
Yeah. Get up, take your bed, and walk, Jesus says to him. And at once the man was healed. And he took up his bed and walked. No need to go for a swim. No need to take a dip. Just his word.
Yeah, well, this is the thing. This man didn't quite understand the question. Jesus didn't ask, do you want someone to throw you in the pool so you can get down there quick when the water gets stirred up? He just asked him if he wants to be healed.
That's right.
And the man says, I would like to get in that pool. And she's like, nah, we're not going to do the pool. How about you just get up?
Yeah. Yeah, that'll work.
Yeah, it's great.
Now, that day was the Sabbath. So the Jews said to the man who had been healed, it is the Sabbath, and it is not lawful for you to take up your bed.
This is
the
unbelievable.
Best thing ever.
Unbelievable. Listen,
if you want to know what legalism sounds like, looks like, smells like, stinks like, this is a wonderful picture of that, folks. Just majoring on the minors. Hey, you know, technically, our law says that you're not allowed to walk with your bed on the Sabbath, and here you are walking with your bed. Who do you think you are?
Yeah, this is where you take something that God says is a good thing, which is the Sabbath. He's going to give you a day of rest. He wants to have a day where you don't do any work. And what do? You make it the most legalistic and burdensome day of the week.
Yeah, it becomes just a tool of oppression, which is what sinners do, by the way, with some... God gives gifts, and we always find a way to make it imprison us.
Yep.
That is our nature. I mean, there's so much that God's creation, we need to remember, folks, God's creation is good. And God's prohibitions, God's commands for us, even something like the Sabbath that is meant for our good, are good things. And we always find a way to abuse them or to use them as tools of oppression for ourselves or for others, which is exactly what they're doing here. So the man answered them, "The man who healed me, that man said to me, take up your bed and walk." They asked him, "Who is the man who said to you, take up your bed and walk?"
They don't even care about the healing. He's like, "Listen, I was lame for 38 years, and this guy healed me, and he told me I could take up my bed and walk." And the healing part goes right by him, and they're like, "Who is this man? Who said you could take up that by the bed?" They're just talking about like a mat, like a cot thing.
Yeah.
Like, okay, that's all nice. Who was it? Who told you that you could take up your bed? Just nuts, man.
Again, legalism 101. Now, the man who had been healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn as there was a crowd in the place. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you." The man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who had healed him. And this was why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, "My Father is working until now, and I am working." In other words, this is God's work. You're not going to thwart it.
Let's talk about this. So Jesus finds this guy.
Yeah.
And says, "Hey, see, you're well." And then says this thing. This is an interesting line here. "Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you." What is that about? Is Jesus saying that you committed some sin and that's why you were lame? I don't think so. We know that Jesus says the opposite of that in numerous other passages.
In fact, in this gospel, he will tell us the opposite of that.
Yeah, so it's not that. Is he saying that if this man doesn't live perfectly from this point on, that something worse than being lame will happen to him? I don't think he's saying that either. What he is saying is that the result of sin is death. Death is worse than being lame. And what he's telling him to do, the reason Jesus finds him, is so that he might know who it was that healed him, so that he might believe in the one who can do something about sin, so that he doesn't just heal a guy who, now a guy who used to be lame, isn't lame, but he's just going to die and go to hell anyway. That's not what Jesus wants. Jesus wants to heal him and give him eternal life.
That's right. And I think it's important here to note the order of things. Jesus doesn't say first, before he heals the man, "Sin no more."
Mm-mm.
"Then I'll heal you." But no, he heals. And then once the man is healed, then the command comes. And the reason that's important, the order is so important, the saving or the healing or the deliverance that God gives to people is not based on how well they do at implementing this command in their life. In the same way that you'll see with the woman who is the adulterous woman a little later on in John's gospel, Jesus says, "I don't condemn you. I've forgiven you. Now go and sin no more."
Yeah.
It's very important for us to keep that order in order to understand that our acceptance by God is not based on how well we do at this thing. Nevertheless, in this man's case, It could be the problem is that you could get physically healed and not deal with the problem of your soul. Mm-hmm. And Jesus doesn't want that for this man.
Yeah.
And he doesn't want that for any of us.
Right. And then, you know, this guy tells the Pharisees that it's Jesus that healed him. And of course, they're extremely upset about this. And it says that this is why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things on the Sabbath. And Jesus' response here, and we're going to break this down a little bit more next week, because this response has a ton to do with what comes next. But this, "My Father is working until now, and I am working." What Jesus is doing there, Sabbath is a day that you don't do work, but Jesus says, "I have actually come to work because of the mission that the Father has given me, because of the work that the Father has given me to do. It doesn't stop on the Sabbath."
That's right. That is correct. In fact, he is the fulfillment of the Sabbath, and so it makes all the sense in the world that he would, in fact, do what the Sabbath was made for, which is to bring life.
Right.
And that's what he does all throughout his ministry.
That's correct. And next week, we'll find out exactly how the Pharisees received this statement by Jesus. A little hint, if they were irritated that he was working on the Sabbath, this statement doesn't alleviate their skepticism or their irritation with him.
No, it doesn't, Dan.
But we'll have to wait till next week to get that. Eric, I'll see you then.
All right, sounds good.